Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We go behind the headlines, reporters' insight into the stories they cover. Joining me are St. Louis Public Radio reporters Rachel Lipman and Joe Manis, and SIU Carbondale journalism professor Bill Freivogel. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you. Hi.
Rachel, I'll begin with you. We'll talk about that consent decree. The Ferguson City Council reversed itself this week and decided to go ahead with and accept and endorse that decree. Did they really have any choice?
I mean, yes, I guess in the sense of the word that they could have, you know, stuck their ground. That could have been their political choice. But realistically speaking, probably not. You had a group of protesters, of activists, basically, I think, willing to shut down government in a sense, be there, be, you know, voice their objection to the rejection of the consent decree consistently and constantly. And I'm just not sure how they, if they saw a path to kind of, you know, move forward and get beyond that to, you know, make other changes to city government. And I think they were also pretty worried about an April election, losing a tax vote that they needed to fund the city, not just to comply with the consent decree, but also just basic city operations. So practically speaking, no, I think they realized, you know what, we need to come to some kind of you know, moment with the Justice Department where they limit the costs a little bit, but implement essentially all of the major changes.
As much about money then as reform.
Yeah. I don't think that they ever were fighting it to say, we don't want to make these reforms. Maybe they were looking for a way to weasel out and not, you know, be bound to, you know, this extensive, in-depth decree, but to find some way to make it a little bit less onerous. And included in there were some agreements that I think cap the – or they proposed agreements that cap the cost over a certain period of time and get more technical assistance from the Justice Department, which comes in free.
One of the councilmen said that Ferguson, with this approval, could become the poster boy for reform. Is that apt, do you think?
I mean, I think it's possible that, you know, this will be the model for how these little North County municipalities are going to work. But we've said time and time and time again on this show and on many other discussions is that what Ferguson does isn't necessarily going to matter unless the other communities around it change as well. It does, you know, it does people no real good in a sense if Delwood and Velda City and Florissant, and I mean, I can think of dozens of other little North County municipalities up there that engage in the same sort of ticketing practices as Ferguson does. How much does it really change to have Ferguson forced to make these reforms and not anywhere else? And I don't see the Justice Department coming in and going after consent decrees and pattern and practice investigations for all of these little different municipalities.
Let's bring Bill Freivogel into the discussion. Bill is a longtime journalist and also an attorney, as regular listeners to this program know. Bill, this now has to go to a judge, however.
Right. But I would think that most likely a judge will approve anything that the Department of Justice and Ferguson have agreed to. So I think it's very likely that a judge will go along. On Rachel's point about how, what about all the other municipalities, I think it's worth noting that the Justice Department sent out a letter earlier this week in which trying to address the broad issues of how municipal courts function. And so I think that's the justice. I think that's a very significant action on their part and something we're going to see a lot more of in the future.
And nothing in this consent decree rules out any kind of individual civil suits that residents of Ferguson may want to bring against the city or any other city. You actually just had recently in Jennings, maybe 3 months ago, they settled a civil suit against the Jennings jail there. It was a fines and fees case and revamped how they handle cash bail and some other things. So it won't come from the Justice Department necessarily, but it'll come through probably legal or court action.
Well, everybody knows now that the Justice Department means business when it comes to things like this, right?
Yes, they do. Yeah. And particularly under this under the Obama administration, there have been a lot of pattern and practice cases and consent decrees.
One other question with regard to what the judge who now has to approve this this document. Suppose the judge decides some changes should be made. What happens then? Does it go back to the Ferguson City Council to be reconsidered once again?
I guess it probably would have to. I guess I don't really expect that. Expect that to happen.
Yeah, you do. You rarely see, if there's a settlement in there, if it's something that both sides have negotiated, a judge wanting to throw this a monkey wrench into it again. It's documented that, you know, we've sat down and we've negotiated this. You know, I'm not saying it's rubber stamp, but I think Bill's right. They're not, they don't want to upset the apple cart much.
Well, I did so want to have fun with this.
I mean, one concern about the consent decrees, there was a piece in Vox this week when Ferguson agreed, looking at the history of past consent decrees. And it found, it looked at 10 different, it was actually a Frontline episode, looking at 10 different cities and found that that had been under consent decrees. In 5 of the 10, the actual use of force had increased rather than decreasing. Mm-hmm. And there were very large costs, you know, going back to Ferguson's original objection.
Bill, I'll turn to you now to just move ahead to the major story this week. It's a national story, but because it involves the Supreme Court, it certainly has local implications. Are you seeing any kind of crack on the united front on the part of the GOP? As several senators who will face tough elections are saying they might now meet with the nominee, and that's a little bit different than what folks were saying a few days ago.
Yeah, there's maybe a little bit of a crack. I think McConnell's still trying to stand very strong on this. But like Rob Portman, who's in a contested election, a re-election campaign in Ohio, has said he would meet. Of course, our senator across the river, Kirk, has said all along that he would meet with Merrick Garland. So I think there's maybe a little bit of movement. You know, this McConnell suggestion that there's some sort of Biden rule that he's just following is a little bit absurd, because in the first place, it wasn't a rule. In the second place, Biden made this speech on June 25th and was talking about an eventuality that could occur over the summer or fall.
It was a hypothetical.
It was a hypothetical. Yes. Also, you know, in 1988, at a time when the country was as much divided as ever over what Supreme Court justice should be like, in 1988, the Democrats and the Judiciary Committee approved Justice Kennedy. That was right after, you know, that very nasty Bork nomination fight. Linda Greenhouse had an interesting piece. She's a former Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, in which she said that you know, people have said, well, you know, this is Borking. This is just another example of Borking. But, you know, in the Bork case, Bork got a vote.
Yeah.
If Garland were Borked, he'd at least get a hearing and a vote.
Right. I saw Washington Post, I think it was Washington Post, speculate that they may do lame duck. So after the presidential election, when they know what the landscape looks like going forward, and they get worried about a Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Democratic presidency, Democratic Senate, that they would just, you know, roll the dice and say, let's take what may be the lesser evil with right. Merrick Garland.
You know, if Trump becomes the nominee, the whole wait for the election thing may look a little different to McConnell. I mean, it's one thing to say we know Ted Cruz would appoint somebody very conservative. Who knows who Trump would appoint? So at that point, they might just say, let's get this done.
We're edging toward politics now, and I want to get Joe into it.
But if this is why Obama selected Garland, he's a 60-something white guy.
60-something.
A moderate record. And I've been wondering all along if he did that because he has a moderate record, so that it makes it more difficult for Republicans to say, well, obviously, we're not going to talk about this guy. But it also puts the Republicans in the swing states who are up for re-election put in the Senate, potentially. If the average voters are like, well, this guy seems okay. I mean, and the average Republican, not the conservatives necessarily, but I just kind of wonder if that was part of Obama's intention, as opposed to picking somebody more conservative or a minority, I mean, more liberal or a minority, or somebody who the Republicans could easily just reject out of hand.
Joe, you've taken us where I wanted to go, and I wanted to go with Bill, and that is, I've heard it said that Obama, in making this nomination, had to avoid trying to be too cute and really angering the already angry Republicans over any choice that he might make. And that's why Jane Kelly of the Eighth Circuit here in St. Louis was not a nominee, although she was high on the list.
Yeah, I mean, I think that President Obama very much wanted to avoid being obviously political by, you know, all the other people who were being considered in sort of the final cut were either women or African Americans. And I think he, you know, you could have made a political argument that, well, if he had nominated one of them, that that would have been a stronger political card for the Democrats to play in the election. And I think he decided to go a totally different way and just put up a person who the Republicans are on the record as saying is a terrific judge. I mean, Orrin Hatch, a very important Judiciary Committee Republican, just said last week that he thought Merrick Garland would be great, but that he was sure Obama wouldn't nominate him.
He was confirmed 96-0 for his current post. Right.
And I'd also seen that the flip side of appointing Merrick Garland to the post is that it's not a candidate that'll gin up the Democratic base. And Joe, you can probably talk to this. I know you guys sort of broke down the numbers. You and Jason broke down the numbers. Is that turnout, there's not much inspiring the Democratic base right now to turn out. That Republican turnout is higher than expected. Democratic turnout may be lower than expected. It may be with monkeying around with ballots and anyone but Trump. But, I mean, how does that kind of play out? Is, you know, get it confirmed, but politically speaking is not – they don't get the boost they want going into the elections.
Well, I think strategically that the president may have been considering that a Supreme Court selection – as far as the Democratic base, may or may not really gin up the rank and file, because many of the people who are behind Sanders, for example, were behind him for other reasons. Doesn't really have anything to do with Supreme Court choices. But B, I think he was looking at these Senate races in these swing states, which include Illinois and possibly Missouri, and was, okay, who would be the best nominee that could put those Republicans on the defensive? That's what I think, and that he was thinking that way, not so much who might whip the base up in November. Because frankly, in many states, I mean, many of the states that the Democrats need to flip aren't necessarily where there's a huge liberal base. Mm-hmm. So I think he was playing more to the middle on this.
So the Democratic Senate is more important than anything else at this point.
It's interesting. Yes. That many Democrats have gone on the record, including Bernie Sanders just the other night, saying that they would not it's not that they wouldn't support him, but they would have selected somebody else. He's not progressive enough, they say. Let's turn to the Missouri primary, Joe. And it's official now. Hillary Clinton is formally declared the winner, I guess, in the Missouri Democratic primary. The question now becomes, what happens now? Where do we go from here? How does the process continue beyond the primary? And you're the person to tell us about that.
Okay. Well, for both parties, while you have these high-profile elections, the nitty-gritty work is still done in caucuses. And will be a series of caucuses. They will begin on April 7th on a Thursday night for the Democrats. They will begin on April 9th, a Saturday morning, for Republicans. They have what's known as mass meetings, and these meetings, there'll be one in the city of St. Louis on each side, and in St. Louis County, there will be 28, one in each of the townships. And a bunch of people show up. I mean, they have different registration processes. You can look on the party's websites. But so anybody can show up there as long as you sign in and everything. And then they'll do some voting, and then they'll select people to go to the next level. They will select delegates, but they won't be the big-name delegates that we've been talking about. These are delegates that go to the next level, which is the congressional caucuses, which are held in April. And that's where most of the delegates who were at stake in Tuesday's election will be picked. Then the next level is the state conventions, which for the Republicans is, I think, in late May. The Democrats, I think it's June, maybe early June or late May. But in any event, they will pick the remaining delegates, and that's where you have your platform fights. That's where they make any decisions on the final breakdowns of the delegates. Now, the Democrats, as I mentioned before, have superdelegates and then regular delegates. The superdelegates are the big shots. The Republicans have a few of those, and those weren't up in Tuesday's primary. But just so people know, okay, Hillary won. The final breakdown for the Democratic delegates, she gets 34, he gets 34. And then that's 68. And then there's, all told, there's 84 in Missouri at stake. So the rest of them are superdelegates or people who will be selected at the higher levels. So the ones that were at stake, they split.
I'm glad the Missouri kept it simple. that makes it a lot easier for people like all of us to follow. Let's talk about the superdelegates for a moment. We hear the term over and over again. These are basically, I guess, Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, ranking people within the Democratic Party. I mean, is Governor Nixon going to go to the convention as a superdelegate?
Right. The governor is a superdelegate. Claire McCaskill is a superdelegate. Usually the members of Congress. There's also the national committee people. Each state has a few. I think Missouri has three, I think. But they're superdelegates, the party chairman. So it's a combination of people who are heavy involved in the party politics and then the major office holders. In fact, I think, I could be wrong, but I think all of Missouri's statewide Democratic office holders are automatically superdelegates.
Well, the question then becomes, are they bound to any particular candidate? Or can they on the first ballot, given what might, well, Democrats are a little bit different, but thinking in terms of the Republican convention, are superdelegates there bound when they go in?
No. Now, the Republicans don't have as many. I mean, this is classic. Republicans keep it so most of these people are bound on the first ballot. The Democrats have a larger group of, and see, the Democrats have more have more delegates. It's just the way they do it. So the Democratic conventions tend to be often a little more wilder because there's more people and there's more of these superdelegates running around, and they can change their affiliation whenever they decide. But most of them now are with Clinton. Now, on the Republican side, there's only a few because it's just the way they do their process. And so most of their delegates that were picked on Tuesday, they will be bound on the first ballot. Now, there's been already some behind-the-scenes talk that many of the people who will be picked to hold those posts, now we're talking about the Republicans now, will be people who, they will be bound to Trump on the first ballot, but many of these people may not actually be Trump people.
You know,
so they could switch.
You know, I'm starting to get a headache. And I think others might be as well.
Gamesmanship is the bottom line.
And part of it is because Trump doesn't have an organization here. I mean, he doesn't have a bunch of officials who endorsed him or anything. Trump won the state by getting the votes. So he doesn't have any people watching out for his interests. So unless he has some big shots here, and right now he doesn't, who monitor this process, he could very well, I mean, in theory, have a bunch of Cruz people picked who are bound to him on the first ballot. But then if he doesn't get it in the first ballot, they're gone.
We'll watch that very closely. You've got to wrap it up, Joe.
Sure.
Thank you for bringing us up to speed. We'll be talking about this a lot over the next couple of weeks. Thanks to Rachel Lipman, Joe Manis, and Bill Freivogel for being with us and taking us behind the headlines. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.